You are listening to The Grandest Tour by The Cycling Podcast. Brought to you by iWocker. Flexible loans built for small businesses. iwoca.co.uk.
Where are we, Lionel?
Where are we?
I just thought I'd throw that in there. It's been a while since I said, where are we, Lionel?
It doesn't say that in the perfectly honed script that we read from every night.
we're at stage 30.
Stage 30, ridiculous. We should have thought about this at the start of the Grandest Tour. What were we
going to
name the episodes?
This was your idea, this Grandest Tour.
In concept, possibly. I mean, yeah, okay, I'll take the blame.
Daniel came up with the name, up with the concept, and I just got carried along. And
you're the only one that's going to complete the entire course, I think.
I'm the Adam Hansen of the Grandest Tour.
Is that right? No, there was an episode that Daniel and I did on our own, wasn't there? The transitional episode. Yeah. No one's finished it this year.
Very low audience figures for that one. I'm not flagging at all, though. I'm still bursting with energy. And we're joined tonight for the last time in the Grandest Tour by Francois Thomazeau. Hello, Francois.
Hi there. Yeah, I feel like you remember in the old days of the tour, the touriste routier. I mean, there were guys who were coming in and out of the tour, you know, just racing in one stage and going out and back. I mean, that's nice as well, you know. They should do that again in Grand Tours. You know, some guys would come just for a stage and go away. Why not?
Well, we do that normally at the Giro and the Vuelta. I've been booking one or two hotels for the Tour de France next year, actually. I'm just looking ahead to a time when Francois will be joining us again. You will join us again, won't you, Francois?
Well, hopefully we'll see. Who knows, you know?
That was a formal offer there. That's how we roll.
We'll discuss the fees. We'll discuss the fees at the end of this, you know. Yeah.
Remember that we're not as wealthy as Panini stickers, so don't get your hopes up.
Oh no! I mean, you can't compete again. That's for sure.
No. Well, stage 30 of the Grandest Tour. What was it? But stage 15 of the Vuelta, Lionel.
That is right. Yes, 16, 17, 18 to go. That's right. Yes, stage 15
and
of the Vuelta.
Yeah, the headline. The headlines, please. A little bit of news from elsewhere in the cycling world today. But what are the headlines from the Vuelta?
Well, we'll get to that other news in the final part, I expect, a sort of any other business section. But if you do hear some banging behind me or around me, it is fireworks night or Guy Fawkes night here in the UK. You'll remember that, Richard. So people are setting off fireworks.
Not many going off here.
In our neighbourhood. I don't know whether it's Guy Fawkes night or is it people celebrating lockdown. I don't know. Anyway, stage 15 of the Vuelta, the longest of the race, 230 kilometres, 6 hours 22 minutes in the saddle for the leaders, cold and wet too, and as we said yesterday, a day for the breakaway, and in it were yesterday's stage winner Tim Wellens of Lotto Soudal, the King of the Mountains elect Guillaume Martin, the Astana pair Alex Aramburu and the Spanish champion Luis Leon Sanchez. Our audio diarist, Nick Schultz of Mitchelton Scott, was in there with his teammate Rob Stannard, Mark Donovan and Robert Power of Sunweb, the former world champion Rui Costa and Jose Joaquin Rojas of Movistar, and also Mattia Cattaneo of De Koninck Quickstep. And he was the last man to be caught with just 3 kilometres to go. And that set up a tricky sprint finish with a peloton that was splitting up as a consequence of the cold and the wet, as much of anything else, I would have thought. And in the finish straight, it was a win for 22-year-old Jasper Philipsen, the man from Mol, which is Tom Bonan's hometown. And it was a Bonan-esque sprint, really. A powerful finish. He was all shoulders and quads on the uphill, slightly uphill run to the line. And he was a pretty convincing winner ahead of Pascal Ackermann of Bora Hansgrohe and Yannick Stiemeler of De Koninck Quickstep in third. Fred Wright, the young British rider with Bahrain McLaren, was fourth. And, well, for Primoz Roglic, it was another day just ticked off without too much incident. A tough one in the saddle and the cold and the wet, but he is one stage closer to repeating last year's Vuelta success, isn't he?
You are listening to The Grandest Tour by The Cycling Podcast. Brought to you by iWalker. Flexible loans built for small businesses. Join 50,000 customers taking on life's twists and turns and scaling new heights with iWalker. If you run a business, find out more at iwalker.co.uk. iwoca.co.uk.
Let's hear again from James Turner, who works for our sponsors iWalker, about the bike ride they did from London to Brighton, which took them over the famous Ivanhoe Beacon and raised money for the Stephen Lawrence Charitable Trust.
It was quite nice because at that point I could sort of get off the leash and just give it a quick crack, because I couldn't believe it, but I'd never actually done ditchling before, so I just gave it a bit of full gas up the climb. I'm always up for helping out on challenges. I'm in a privileged position with my fitness and my experience of cycling, so it's really good to be able to sort of bring people along in their cycling journeys. And it's been great seeing people take on the challenge of sort of really going on their own cycling journey. We have a lot of people in the office that sort of see me commuting in to the office and ask me questions about how they can get into commuting in themselves. And then we have discussions around what sort of bike will suit them best. And we've had a number of people sort of certainly at the moment take on the mantle of cycling in lieu of using public transport with our new normal. My commute at the moment, I probably cycle into the office 2 or 3 times a week at the moment, and that's 45 kilometres each way. And it's interesting to see this sort of change in the makeup of the traffic and the cyclists. And it's definitely been an evolution of how things are on the roads. In some ways, it's got better, and in other ways, it's the same or worse. I think in general, I definitely see a lot more normal cyclists, if you can call them that.
As we heard from Liv Denyer in a recent episode, the ride raised around £12,000 for the charity, and iWalker have matched that too. If you want to find out about how iWalker's services can help your small business, go to iwalker.co.uk. That's iwoca.co.uk.
Well, we'll hear from our audio diarist Nick Schultz soon. He was in that big breakaway. And we'll also hear from Daniel Freib later. And we were talking, Daniel and I, while the stage was going on and when it looked as if the breakaway would stay away. It was a strong break and they had a pretty big lead. But Daniel had been surprised this morning to hear a few riders talking about it possibly coming down to a bunch sprint, because it didn't look like that on paper. But that is clearly what Bora Hansgrohe and others wanted. Not the Koenig Quickstep necessarily, although, as you mentioned, Lionel there, young sprinter, was up there, but Sam Bennett was dropped in one of the climbs. A sprint it was. And Jasper Philipsen, his first Grand Tour win, he's a very promising young sprinter, and maybe a bit more than that. He is stepping down though next year, moving to Alpes and Fenix, so dropping out of the World Tour, although Alpes and Fenix are, you know, all but World Tour, and they are stepping up, so it could actually be a good opportunity for him there. But it was a very good sprint. He got the line right, like yesterday. Getting the line right was important. He had a fantastic lead out as well from Ivo Oliveira at UAE Team Emirates. Michael Morkov did a good job for Steimler, but Steimler went a different way to Morkov, which maybe ruined that. I was surprised by Ackermann. Ackermann was kind of outmaneuvered by Philipsen. He got a bit physical, but he doesn't seem to have the speed that we've seen in the past for Ackermann. Maybe it's a bit too late in the year for him, I don't know. But a very well taken win by Jasper Philipsen.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, you mentioned Ackermann. He was, well, for me, well, he won a stage, but we know how he won it. He actually, you know, he won it on paper. But a big disappointment. You would have thought, you know, with Bennett, he would be by far the leading force in the sprints. And Philip, we knew what Philipsen could do. And if you saw the celebrations at the end of the stage with Machin and all the guys from the UAE team, embracing him and kissing him around, they really, you know, they expected this to happen one day. Well, unfortunately for them, he's leaving at the end of the season. But he's been one of the hopeful. As you said, I dare not say sprinters because, as you say, it's probably more than this. But he still needed this great first, Grand Tour victory. And what next? I mean, there was lots of discussion on French TV about his abilities in the classics, and French Eurosports consultant Jackie Durand, who should know because he won a couple, said he saw him do well in the Flanders Classics more than in the Ardennes Classics. But well, it's a little bit early to say. But yeah, he belongs to this 22-year-old generation, went through a famous team, you know, that from which lots of the under 23 riders come from. He's following the pattern that, you know, the current up and coming stars of cycling have been through. So yeah, it'll be exciting to see what he does. Another little thing that Jackie Durand, you know, pointed out in the finish is that because of the rain today, so some riders were wearing rain jackets and others didn't. And according to Durand, the fact that Philipsen was just wearing his jersey for aerodynamics might have, you know, be an advantage in the sprint. Who knows?
Yeah, you mentioned Philipsen came through Axel Merckx's development team, Hagens Burman Action. So did his lead-out man today, mm-hmm. Ivo Oliveira.
Yeah, if you think back to last year's Tour de France, Rich, he was in the UAE Team Emirates lineup, and he and Alexander Kristoff, were sort of sharing sprint duties, weren't they? And Philipsen had a crash on the day that Julian Alaphilippe won to Epernay, the Champagne stage, and I think he might have crashed again. He pulled out of the race in when it reached the mountains. But I must admit, when you look at UAE Team Emirates, and until obviously Tadej Pogacar winning the Tour de France, you would have thought that Philipsen would be the kind of rider that they would be very keen to hold on to, a sort of successor in waiting to Alexander Kristoff, similar in as a sprinter who can probably turn his hand very much to the classics. They've obviously got Matteo Trentin arriving next year as well, so maybe it's as simple as not enough room on that particular compartment in the team when perhaps so much of the resources will be focused around supporting Pogacar in the Tour de France, of course.
Apparently, from what Machin Fernandez was saying on Eurosport, it was Philipsen's choice to go to Alpecin, and not UAE apparently wanted to keep him, but who knows, you know.
I mean, he is going to what is a very good team, which I think this year has proven that they're more than just Matthew van der Poel. Somebody asked me on Twitter recently actually whether there were parallels with Bora Hansgrohe. You know, when they signed Peter Sagan, a lot of people thought they would be a one-man team, and they are certainly not that. Alps and Fenix seem to be going in a similar direction. They've had a very good year, and definitely more than just the Van der Poel show, and they're obviously stepping up again next year. May well be at the Tour de France next year as well.
Yeah, so guys, I mean, exciting sprint in a way. I mean, not what we expected, but it was interesting in the finale. But on the French corner side today, I mean, the big news was obviously that Guillaume Martin now, I mean, if he doesn't crash or if anything, you know, untimely happens before they reach Madrid, he'll keep the polka dot jersey. He'll be the king of the mountains, and it's kind of become, well, it's an achievement for Martin. We've been saying all along, you know, how he improved this year, and it's funny because it's become a kind of a French specialty or French property, the polka dot jersey in the Vuelta, and it's also become kind of Cofidis specialty, because remember David Moncoutier won it 4 times, and Nicolas Hédé won it once, and now Guillaume Martin, who's also Cofidis, and of course the other winners of the King of the Mountain jersey, in the French winners were Luc Leblanc and Laurent Jalabert, and last year Geoffroy Bouchard. So that's quite well. It's a jersey, obviously, that's, you know, really coveted in France. A little bit different, blue instead of red dots. But once again, I given the season he's had, I think you know, Guillaume Martin really deserved to win something. And there you are.
Well, he has definitely stepped up this year, hasn't he? And it would be nice to see him win a stage. He probably deserves a stage win at the Vuelta.
Well, maybe on Saturday, the crowning final mountain stage in the King of the Mountain jersey, just on the Cofidis link as well, Francois, that you point out. It's probably quite an important competition or a good way for Cofidis to make an impression in the Vuelta. Of course, Cofidis has been a long-time partner of the Vuelta, sponsored the race for, I think, since 2009, and has just last year has extended for another couple of years. So it's a long-standing partnership, that, between the Vuelta and Cofidis. And of course, when the riders cross the line, the word they see on the finish line is Cofidis, isn't it? But I'm not sure I'm a fan of the irregular sized blue polka dots. It does. I'd much rather the polka dots were all the same size and not in nice neat rows like the Tour de France jersey is now, but no, just normal size dots would do me.
Well, I'm actually looking at in front of me a big picture of Bernard Hinault wearing the polka dot jersey in 1986, and it's a classic of the genre.
You mean the Tour de France one?
Anyway.
An aside, I'm sure I've mentioned this before, or people may have heard this before, but back in the day, in the 80s, when the classification was sponsored by Café de Colombia, the Colombian coffee producer, the polka dots were actually coffee beans. little brown, dark, very dark brown or black coffee beans. There you go.
Were they throughout the 80s?
Not throughout the 80s. No, for a few years in the 80s, in the Vuelta.
For a few years.
In the Vuelta, I'm talking about, not the Tour de France.
Oh, sorry. No. Okay,
Tour de France has always been red dots.
Yeah.
In the Vuelta.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah.
They were slightly, in 89, they had a bit of a feature to them, did they not? The polka dots?
Oh, yeah. Well, now you're in my home territory, the Mario Schifano
of
jersey
course, yeah.
designs.
Yeah.
They were red polka dots with little mountain profiles of famous Tour de
That's
France
right.
mountains drawn on them. Very attractive.
Anyway,
they were too.
A bit of a digression yeah. here from the 2020
the question
Vuelta,
to which I don't know the answer, but is why are the dots blue in Spain, you know? It's a silly question, probably to be different from the Tour de France, but yeah, why? And maybe there's an explanation.
We'll have to get Daniel to investigate
Things Daniel should know, or at least he must have an idea.
Well, let's hear from Nick Schultz, shall we, our audio diarist from Michelin Scott. He had a big day out today, and he, like most of us, must have thought that break had a more than reasonable chance of staying away to the finish.
Stage 15, what can I say? Another super hard start. A couple of guys went early, and it looked like Bora were very intent on controlling that, and it looked set to be a controlled day, which would have been nice. But Cajarral missed it, and they started chasing, and it all came back together, and then kicked off again, which took us into around the 50 kilometer point, where there was a Cat 3 climb. Where I was super attentive in marking moves and trying to get into a bigger group. It didn't go there, but we went down a descent, and there was a little kicker just after that, and a group of us went away. it ended up being 13 or so riders, I think, and a really, really strong group. Some serious names in there, guys with a lot of breakaway experience, certainly guys that know how to pick it, and we thought it was actually going to be a breakaway that went to the line with the sort of caliber that was in there. I also had a teammate in there in Rob Stannard, which was really good to have both of us up there, sort of have two different bases covered. If it were to go the distance, I would have been able to cover the moves on the climbs towards the finish, with Rob saving himself for the sprint to see super quick. We discussed that, as we did think the break was going to go to the line, but ultimately it didn't happen. And to be honest, I'm pretty deflated. You do a lot of work, longest stage of the race, wasn't ideal conditions, there was a blockhead wind, and to sort of do all that to get in the break first of all, and then work your ass off all day to then be caught with 15k to go. It's not ideal, but it just feels like wasted energy. But ultimately, like every breakaway in cycling, generally the bunch decides, and today they decided that they wanted to bring it back, and no matter how hard you ride up front, you're never going to resist a charging peloton. But we had a backup in Dion Smith, and Callum Scotson gave him an awesome lead out into the finish there, and he was able to get fifth. Which is just an awesome result. It was a little bit weird coming into the finish because there was some oil on the road, so they decided to stop all the times at 3k to go. So basically, once we hit that 3k to go, the bunch splintered, and there was a small group of guys who went to contest the stage, and then the rest of the bunch sort of rolled safely in. It was also super cold at that point. Ridiculous. Oh, I think one of the coldest moments I've ever had on a bike, after the top of the last climb, descending down into the finish. It was just horrible. But another few days to go, and we'll keep trying and looking for that opportunity and see what comes of it.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, Cycling Podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour at the Tour de France, to remind us to tell you that this episode is sponsored by LACA, which is a community of cyclists all cooperating to provide insurance cover for their bikes and equipment and all of that kind of thing. And, well, we've got our own cycling podcast community within the LACA community, haven't we, Richard? So if people sign up and enter the code TCP, they can become part of our community as well as the wider LACA community. And LACA are also doing a crowdfunding effort to fund the next stage of the company's development, and check out laca.co.uk for details of that as well, because they're offering equity for anyone who invests, and the minimum investment is a very manageable, very reasonable £10.
Well, LACA are cyclists. They won't be fazed by expensive bikes or fancy kits when you take out your insurance. The premium you pay goes up and down according to other claims, but there is an upper limit. If this sounds like the kind of bike insurance you might be interested in, go to laca.co.uk and use the code TCP when you sign up. But don't take our word for it. Let's hear from a satisfied LACA customer.
My name's Ed Block. Took up cycling just over 2 years ago as part of a challenge to do Land's End to John O'Groats, which we did in September 19. Started out with very basic bike, didn't even consider insurance because of the relatively low value of it. But once I started realising that cycling was going to become part of my life, I got more expensive bikes and eventually decided that I needed to get some insurance. And through word of mouth, really, I came across LACA, signed up for them. It seemed like a really good idea. I like the idea of the fluctuating premiums based on the level of claims that they're receiving. the bike that I'd used for Land's End to John O'Groats got a crack in it about 9 months after we got back. I went originally down the warranty route with Scott. So as soon as Scott said that they weren't going to cover it under warranty, that's when I made the claim with ACCA. And it couldn't have been a simpler claim process. I sent in a couple of photos of the crack and then had an email from them to ask a bit more about the circumstances and when it had happened. And fortunately, I did know exactly when it happened because I heard the crack happen while I was out on a ride. So I just gave them that information about where it happened and when. They pretty much immediately agreed to pay for a replacement frame, which came from Scott to the bike shop where I'd originally bought the bike from. And they shipped it to me. And I, in fact, had the payment from ACCA before I actually paid out to the bike shop. So yeah, it was completely smooth, very quick. Got the replacement frame. Interestingly, they even proactively offered to pay for any labour costs that would be involved in swapping all the components from the original bike onto the new frame. But as it turned out, I was planning to do that myself anyway. Very impressed. ACCA themselves were quick as I could have hoped. And in fact, kept chasing me to say, when can we pay you? Which was a bit surprising, but really, really welcome.
Once again, to sign up to LACCA Insurance, go to lacca.co.uk. That's LAKA. And use the code TCP. That will put you in the Cycling Podcast community within LACCA. Well, Daniel, you've made it to the finish town. Puebla la Salabria.
Puebla de Sanabria.
De Salabria.
Sanabria. Sanabria. Sorry. Sorry. I have to. Really close.
Yeah. I'm thinking of somewhere else. But you battled the headwind. What I want to ask you about is, you know, in your role with ITV at the Vuelta, you often have to interview the main British interest, obviously.
Yes.
A couple of years ago, it was Simon Yates. This year, it's Hugh Carthy.
Thought you were going to say it's Harry Tanfield then.
Well, he's
sadly
out. He's out, yeah.
Yeah, sadly, yeah. He's out today, and he's given us a lot of fun over the last couple of weeks.
Yeah, yeah, he has. He has. He's been a great character, but so is Hugh Carthy in his own way. Who's your favourite interview, Simon Yates or Hugh Carthy?
Well, you know what you're going to get with Simon Yates, always, pretty much, down to the last syllable. that's not the case necessarily with Hugh Carthy, although I feel like I'm starting to decipher. I'm starting to figure out what it is that's likely to, you know, get the kind of response you want. What goes down best is the sort of laconic, slightly obtuse,
arched
tangential, yeah, that version of Hugh Carthy.
Yeah.
I listened to the Mitch Docker podcast, by the way, last night, Rich. Very good. Also, I did a double header back to back. I listened to the previous one that Mitch had done with Hugh Carthy. Quite fascinating.
Yeah, a different side to him, definitely. I spoke to Mark Donovan the other day as well, the young British rider who trains quite a lot with Hugh Carthy, and he spoke of another side to him where you really can't get him to shut up. He's a big talker. But we're getting to know him, I suppose, and understand him. I mean, what are the buttons that you press? Because, I mean, your job is, you know, you've got to ask him pretty focused questions. You don't have very long. You can hear in an interview with Mitch Docker that he's an interesting guy. There's a lot going on there. But it's quite difficult to maybe extract that from him or get that side of him in the sorts of interviews that you have to do.
Yeah, well, we've got some mutual friends. Hugh Carthy and I have got some mutual friends. You probably know who I'm talking about, Rich, who has in one case helped me a little bit, given me a bit of a primer on what's likely to set Hugh Carthy off. A lot of them are
I know who you're talking about. Yeah.
A lot of them are topics that maybe quite comically are completely foreign to me, of course, like you know, Preston bus station.
Well,
never into Preston.
The mutual friend suggested Preston bus station, did he not?
Well, I don't want to disclose anything that might give away his identity or her identity or her identity. Biscuits, you know, I get, someone will, our producer or director will probably get me asking about tea sooner or later. And, all subjects that are very much, well, they're not really part of my lexicon.
No, I guess when I think why Simon Yates and Hugh Carthy both come into my head, partly because of the Vuelta, but they're similar in a way. And I think in his early years, Simon Yates always had
when you did these interviews, or when I did these interviews, when anyone interviewed him, you always had the sense that he was thinking, what's this for? Why am I doing this? And I've had that impression myself with Hugh Carthy as well at times. But is he, I mean, in the position he's in now, he must be quite in demand. Do you sense that he is coming around to that and understanding, you know, what is required of him in that situation?
I think so. Over the past few days, he seems to have quite enjoyed his media duties. Well, enjoyed, at least in the sense that he's been very, very available, very amenable. The team doesn't have a press officer, press attaché at the race, so the riders have to field the, well, certainly in the mix zone in the morning, they go up to sign on, and then when they come off, there are a couple of people working for the Welt organiser who sort of points them in our direction, but they're not forced to come into the mix zone. It's on other teams, it tends to be the press officers who are funneling them towards us. In Carthy's case, you know, he's at liberty to say no, which, you know, he did at times earlier in the race, but over the last few days he's been coming in every day and he moves along the line, and I get the sense he very much enjoys doing the Spanish interviews. I think he enjoys, well, as we heard in Mitch's podcast, he enjoys being in Spain, speaking Spanish. I actually asked you this morning, Rich, it was a question that you've put to me. You put to me a couple of times about whether Hugh feels he becomes a different person when he's in Spain, and
he gave a short shrift, that didn't get a very good
response, not the sort of elaborate florid response I was hoping for, but that is the sense that I've had. And I think I don't know, maybe I'm speaking out of turn here, but I get the sense he's enjoying how much everyone else is enjoying his personality, and he can see that he's tickling people, and you know, there's been stuff on social media. I know he doesn't use social media himself, but I'm sure he's aware of some of it, that people are starting to see him as a bit of an extrovert and an unusual character.
And, yeah, he's an original, isn't he?
Yeah, and I think he's quite conscious of that, and not to say it's contrived, because I don't think it is, but you know, it's possibly someone being appreciated for being appreciated as they are, and for being comfortable in their own skin, which is nice, I suppose. And you know, I think the one thing that Hugh Carthy gives off and exudes really is the sense of someone who has gone their own way throughout their life. You know, I was interested to learn a bit more about his background and his upbringing in Preston. I mean, I think there were various sort of interfaces with cycling. There were, you know, it's not as though he discovered cycling out of nowhere, as some of these pros do. But I don't think he was steeped in it necessarily either. But then certainly as he got older, he definitely went his own way. You know, when he joined Caja Rural, which was a really fascinating decision and a fascinating period. And you know, I've spoken to quite a few people over the last few days about how that's influenced him and how it affected him. And you know, it's difficult to imagine an alternative. What would have happened if he'd gone down an alternative path? It's difficult to imagine him here at the Vuelta riding for Ineos as their maybe, you know, their second or third leader, and how that alternative version of events could have played out.
Yeah, absolutely fascinating to hear from that conversation with Mitch as well. How unlikely it is that he's in this sort of form at the Vuelta. You know, that you know, he was given the choice not to ride it, and he was pretty broken after the Tour and the Worlds and Flesh Wallonne. So, yeah, fascinating. That was a really interesting thing to hear about as well. How about the race itself, Daniel? I mean, sort of quietish few days really before Saturday. We spoke to you earlier. Now that you're on the final straight, how is it all gone? I mean, from a COVID point of view, it's obviously been a very successful event.
Yeah, I think from a racing point of view, we all looked at this last week and thought that it was going to be a bit of an anticlimax. But I think all of these were, so there are three back-to-back stages, we're in the middle one at the moment, which throw up the possibility of, well, sprints or breakaways, and you know, there's an outside chance every day of some kind of GC action. And you know, I think the Vuelta has really been at the cutting edge of providing a kind of new blueprint for Grand Tours over the last 15, 20 years. I think the Tour de France has been heavily influenced by Vuelta roots and the identity that the Vuelta has tried to give itself. And this year we've had 18-stage Vuelta. I'm not necessarily suggesting that the other Grand Tours will want to go down that path in the future, but that's been interesting. Mm. And just how few nailed-on sprint finishes there have been. Even today, so we've got 50 or 60 kilometres to go today. And I was quite staggered this morning when I spoke to Zdeněk Stybar and heard from a couple of other people in sprint teams when they said that they might work for a sprint, because we'd sort of written this stage off as a breakaway stage. And, when you open the road book and you see a profile that's very difficult to sort of interpret, I think that's a really good thing. And we've had it sort of drummed into us that sprinters are entitled to 7 or 8 nailed-on opportunities per Grand Tour. But that's a dogma that maybe we'll increasingly question. I think at the Tour de France and the Giro to a certain extent this year, we were blessed by the points jersey competitions, which made a lot of very interesting stages out of days that could otherwise have been quite routine with breakaways. But both that and the paucity of sprint finishes here, they might prompt someone to reevaluate the place in the Grand Tours of tapestry or the Grand Tour narrative that sprint finishes should have.
Mm. Well, as we watch, the break might not be guaranteed to stay away at all. Still a long way to go. We are watching our diarist, Nick Schultz here, another rider who came through Caja Rural, went a slightly different route like Hugh Carthy. But it's by no means certain that they'll stay away. We'll leave you to get to the finish, Daniel, and for some more verbal jousting with Hugh Carthy.
Could be. It sounds quite daunting. I'm slightly nervous every time he sidles over. And yeah.
Well, he did say he could have been a teacher, and he has that air about him. I called him Mr. Carthy in last night's episode.
Yeah. What would he? He didn't say what he would teach, did he? But he was quite sincere about that, wasn't he?
Yeah. What would he teach? Maybe Spanish or history or something.
I would say history would be a good bet. History possibly woodwork. I can imagine he's a woodwork tin now.
quite far apart. Maybe woodwork or history.
CDT.
The history of woodwork.
My worst subject at school, woodwork.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much indeed to Science in Sport for their support of the Cycling Podcast. If you want 25% off all your Science in Sport products, go to scienceinsport.com, enter the code SISCP25 at the checkout. We heard in last night's episode from James Morton at Science in Sport, answering a listener's question. We've got more from James to hear in future episodes. But if you have a question about nutrition for James, do email us, contact@thecyclingpodcast.com. And also, if you have a question for us for our press conference episode, which will be next week's episode after the Grandest Tour finishes on Sunday, email us, contact@thecyclingpodcast.com. And if you can send us an audio file. We do like to hear your voices. And we got so many audio questions at the Tour de France that we weren't able to get to any of the written questions. So we will definitely prioritize audio questions. We heard from Daniel there. That was interesting to hear about his burgeoning relationship with Hugh Carthy. It's all going very well. They'll be firm friends by the end of the Vuelta. A couple of other bits of business in this part of the episode. We sadly lost a rider today, a guy we've heard a bit from and who Daniel mentioned there. He was the Lantern Rouge, wasn't he? But Harry Tanfield
Had to pull out the Vuelta today.
Well, yeah, let's hear very briefly from Harry Tanfield, who will be flying back to the UK, I think, from Spain tomorrow. He'd been struggling with a muscle injury since before the rest day, and had been hoping that the rest day and a couple of easy-ish days might help him get through, but sadly not to be.
So, yeah, just finished stage 15 of this year's Vuelta, and it's my last one, so I'm flying back to the UK tomorrow. It was a pretty hard day out there for the 3 hours that I was on the bike anyway. Was struggling quite a bit with my VM muscle in my leg from last week. It was alright yesterday, but came back on today, and that combined with bad legs as well, which they were pretty bad yesterday, but today was just relentless headwind and uphill, so the moment you're not in the peloton, you lose a lot of time pretty quick. And yeah, as much as I could ride 300, 350 watts, I probably still wouldn't have been able to make the time cut even with that. And my stomach was hurting, I couldn't really eat. I was just completely broken, to be honest, so yeah, had to pull the pin.
Well, it was Harry Tanfield, and a corrections corner. He wasn't Lantern. He was Lantern Rouge last week, but I kind of hadn't been keeping my eye on that part of GC, and he actually moved up quite a few places thanks to a very good time trial the other day. So at the start of today's stage, he was 144th with four other riders behind him on GC. But he's out of the race, and that's sad news. It was his first Grand Tour, and he is... he's out of a contract at the end of the year, isn't he? So it's not a great way for him to finish the Vuelta, but it sounds like he didn't have a choice in the end. A rider who is very much still in the Vuelta and riding well, he's been in a couple of breakaways, and he was up there on Saturday's stage, is Mark Donovan, a young rider at Team Sunweb. And, you know, he came through the Team Wiggins setup. He's good friends with James Knox, who of course kept a diary for us at the Giro recently. They're from the same part of the world, the Lake District, and in fact I think they still live together in Girona. They share an apartment in Girona. He's still only 21, Mark Donovan, and I caught up with him on the rest day just to find out how his first Grand Tour was going.
How are you finding your first Grand Tour? How is the body recovering?
Yeah, I mean, it's been obviously, yeah, pretty tough. I mean, that's a bit of an understatement, but yeah, it's big race. You know, lots of good guys, and it's been a big old fight pretty much every day, really, to get in the break. There's been some extremely hard days, but yeah, I think it felt like I've been sort of coping with it pretty well. I mean, we're 2 weeks into it now, and you know, I'm tired, but I'm not. Don't feel like I'm completely out of it yet. Mm. Yeah, still pretty happy to be doing a ride like I did on Saturday. You know, almost 2 weeks into the race, kind of didn't really, you know, obviously first Grand Tour, I didn't really know what to expect. You know, how the body was going to react, but yeah, I'm pretty real happy with how it's going.
Is there anything about the racing as well that's different, that's taken you by surprise?
Not so much, really. I mean, I think, yeah. I mean, it's just maybe just the amount of days that, you know, people are really keen to get in these breaks. You know, obviously you got the GC guys, but then pretty much everybody else is sort of aiming for a bit of a, you know, to get lucky in a break. So yeah, it's never easy. And you know, you often end up with you know, real strong guys at the end. You know, you don't get, there's never no such thing as an easy day, really.
I mean, you're still a very young rider. I mean, it wasn't so long ago that guys your age would only have done half of a Grand Tour, but things have changed completely. Now, you know, when you look around and you see so many young riders doing so well, including guys on your own team, how does that make you feel? Does that add a pressure, or does it actually create opportunities for you?
Yeah, it's sort of a, it's a funny one, actually. I've kind of been thinking about that a little bit. I guess, in a way, you sort of, people are now expecting you to sort of do a bit better. Maybe, you know, a few years back, you never really expect someone in the first or second years to be, you know, up there. But now that there's all these young guys doing crazy rides, winning, you know, winning the Tour de France and all that sort of stuff, that it kind of gives you, it gives you motivation, and sort of you feel like you can, you can kind of do that. But then also, yeah, I guess it is a little bit more pressure, but kind of a good sort of pressure.
And
I mean, like, I was, you know, two years ago I was as an under 23, I was doing L'Avenir with Podrica.
Yeah.
And then, you know, just this year, you see him winning the Tour, and it's a bit like, I was, you know, racing with these guys not very long ago, and racing with them. So it's sort of, yeah, it's pretty kind of motivating, really.
Well, after French Corner earlier, this is a bit like British Corner, isn't it? Because the other thing we wanted to mention in tonight's episode was the retirement announced today of Ian Stannard. Rheumatoid arthritis, unfortunately, has ended his career. He's had a very good career. He's been at Team Sky, now Team Ineos, right from the start, a real stalwart of that team. I think they've really missed him, actually, in the classics the last couple of years, when he's not really been performing as well as he's done in the past. They've really, really missed him, and a lot of their results in the classics over the years have been entirely down to him. Sad way for him to end his career, but obviously his health comes first.
Yeah, you mentioned there, Richard, that he's been with Team Sky, Team Ineos, since the very beginning. Can you name any other riders who've been with the team since the very beginning?
Geraint Thomas.
Geraint Thomas, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I'll spoil it for you. Chris Froome, of course.
Getting their roster up.
Don't look it up. And then pretend that it's just tumbling forth from your enormous brain. Chris Froome, of course, he'll be leaving to join Israel Startup Nation next season. And Ben Swift, who, of course, went away and has come back.
No. Yeah, but he went away and came back, though, didn't he? He's not been there throughout. He's not been there throughout.
How about Luke Rowe? How about Luke Rowe? He's been
not
there.
Not from somewhere. I think he joined in 2012.
There we are. But
Is that it? So next year it'll just be Geraint Thomas, won't it?
It will. Dario Cioni, of course, was a rider in the first year and still on the management staff. Mm-hmm. But Ian Stannard, I mean... well, what can we say? I mean, the one standout moment has to be the day he completely mugged Quickstep. And you were there, Richard, weren't you, in Omloop Het Nieuwsblad. And, I mean, that was a heck of a performance, wasn't it? The odds were so firmly stacked against him in that run-in, and he pulled it off absolutely brilliantly. But also on the podium at Paris-Roubaix, and a real strong team rider, reliable. And I'm sure, you know, he'll be missed, and particularly, you know, to have to retire and deal with rheumatoid arthritis. I mean, that's not something that's particularly compatible with being a World Tour cyclist, is it?
No, and a collection of very strong placings in races, and as you say, well, he won Het Nieuwsblad twice, and that second one was particularly memorable, as was my interview the following morning with Patrick Lefebvre, the Quickstep boss, who was really didn't see the funny side of it, shall we say, at that point. But yeah, he will be missed. And I say, I think that his team have really, they need somebody like that, who also creates opportunities for other riders just by his very presence. Because although he didn't win one of the big, you know, the major classics, he was always a contender, always a favourite, and always somebody who was a very good foil for other riders. And they really do miss that at the moment if they want to have success in the classics.
Just going back right to the very beginning, because it just occurred to me that Stannard and Geraint Thomas were while Stannard was second and Geraint Thomas was first in the junior Paris-Roubaix way back in 2004. And if you think about the kind of the genesis of the British cycling boom, that was still in the era when people were saying, well, it's all very well winning medals on the track, but what about road success? You're not going to make road riders by concentrating on track events. And I think, you know, both, well, certainly, you know, they were going off to get top results in what admittedly at the time was still quite a it was a very young event. The first edition was only held the year before. I suppose it's become much more of an obvious pathway, especially when you look at the run of winners sort of at the start of this decade: Jasper Stuyven, Florian Seneschal, Mads Pedersen, among others. But a race that has also had a very strong British presence over the years. Lewis Askey and Tom Pidcock have won it recently, but Geraint Thomas and Ian Stannard were the two trailblazers in that respect. And I think that's actually quite an important little step on the British cycling journey.
Yeah, seen from the outside, he was the typical tough guy, you know, a little bit like you know, English defenders as we saw it in France in the old days. I mean, the guy, yeah, I mean, the guy who doesn't look much, but you can't, you know, you can't get past him. I mean, he was, and also to keep with the football comparison, you know, there are guys in teams where, you know, you don't really know what they're doing, but when they're in the team wins, and when they're not in the team loses. And, in you know, seen from outside of Britain, that's a little bit the kind of rider Stannard appeared to us, you know, really really tough, solid guy. And yeah, I mean, that is, I think, kind of a character that's going to be missed. And the other thing I wanted to say about it is that at the beginning of this strange season, there were a few stories saying, you know, discussing or elaborating on the downfall and maybe the death of British cycling and the end of an era and blah blah blah. But when you look now, okay, Stannard is you know, is giving up, unfortunately. And but I mean, the baton has been passed, you know, as you were mentioning before, Ari Enfield, Pidcock, I mean, all these guys, I mean, obviously Gegenhardt. There's I think the baton has been passed pretty quickly and handed pretty quickly. And well, unfortunately, British cycling is here to stay.
Are you saying then, Francois, if he's like an old British central defender, he's the Terry Butcher of the peloton?
Terry Butcher.
I was a great fan of Phil Neal at the time, you know. But I mean, yeah,
but Stannard's work as a teammate in Grand Tours. I mean, easy to kind of overlook the role he's played, but he was a finisher in three of Chris Froome's Tour victories and also in Chris Froome's 2017 Vuelta victory. And so that bears out what you're saying, really, there, Francois.
He was also in Chris Froome's 2011 Vuelta victory.
Oh, of course, yeah.
He was a part of that team.
Well done.
He rode 10 Grand Tours, only failed to finish one at the Vuelta in 2010. And, you know, whenever I saw him at races, he's a big guy. Looked like a rugby player, actually, more than a central defender. I was always amazed that he got around. You know, he's 83 kilos. Hope for us all. And you saw Ian Stannard in Paris having made it round another lap of
we've
France.
We've got to get down, to 83 body kilos over the Alps first, so Rich.
Yeah. Anyway, power to weight ratio through the roof. Anyway, we should wrap things up for tonight, chaps. Well, Francois, au revoir. Mm-hmm. And for now. I mean, I did sort of float the idea of you contributing in song, in the form of song, over the next few weeks and months. And well, we're waiting for our listeners to get in touch and suggest with their requests for Jukebox Tomaso.
Yeah, I'd be more than happy to oblige. I mean, if there are no requests, well, never mind, I won't. But otherwise, yeah, I'd be, you know, we're all in lockdown again, so I have plenty of time.
Well, if you've got a question,
well, I remember,
what
actually
about a question for Francois, yeah, as well, if we're taking questions for our press conference?
Absolutely,
a question for him to answer in song,
maybe.
While we're on the subject of requests, and I'm not gonna ask you to sing Happy Birthday, Francois, but if you want to, that's fine. But We did get an email, and it's a bit early. Apologies, Emily Corbu. Corbu, I think, is your name. You emailed us and asked whether we could say happy birthday to your sister, Beth. Her birthday is on November the 12th. But I'm not sure we'll have an episode out that day. We are coming to a stop soon, going back to weekly. She's in Australia, and they both listen to the podcast, so that's very nice. And happy birthday, Beth. Well, we'll play out with Francois singing happy birthday to you. In French.
You want me to do that?
Go
now?
On.
Okay. Joyeux anniversaire, joyeux anniversaire, joyeux anniversaire. What's
Beth,
your first name?
Do that again.
Joyeux. Okay, do it again. Joyeux anniversaire, joyeux anniversaire, joyeux anniversaire, Beth. Joyeux anniversaire.
Fantastic. Thank you, Francois.
There you are.
Thank you, Lionel.
Thank you, Rich.
See you soon.
Thank you, Francois.
Thank you, Lionel. Bye-bye.